Mini episode 159 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by Outside the Box Score, your home on the web for entertaining sports columns and videos. Follow them on the web at OutsideTheBoxScoreBlog.com.
The FDH Lounge. You want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Alrighty, folks. Mini episode number 159 and part 2A of the Kyle Ross SummerSlam anthology. Rick Morris and Kyle Ross coming at you with this FDH Lounge mini episode here. We are reconvening here to discuss, I believe this will be SummerSlams 93 through 95. Not quite consequential enough to merit much individual treatment here.
No. And building up from where we left off in the last time, Ricky, we talked about SummerSlam 92, obviously the first pay-per-view post Hulk Hogan.
Yes.
And what we're going to see here, I think the theme, at least at the outset, until we get wrap up today, a little bit later on, when we talk about, you know, SummerSlam's 97, pretty much, it's a steady decline from year to year with a lot of creative faux pas.
Yep.
I think that it's funny because I've made the point, I think, to you before, this point to you and to others as well, that the way the WWE is set up now, presently, 2012, in case if you stumble across this podcast, you know, in 2020, in 2012, the WWE is set in a way that it will never achieve the heights of, you know, 1985 to 1987 or 1998 to 2001, just arbitrarily picking years. You know the eras.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it will never sink to the depths that we're about to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
And with the void left by the Hogan departure, they tried a lot of wild things. You know, they don't try really wild things. You know, they'll occasionally try today, and then when it kind of fails for 2 weeks, they put John Cena back on top.
Yeah.
Now, they went all in on some bad misfires during these years we're going to talk about. And I think that is one of the connections there is between at least the first three SummerSlams we're going to talk about, 93, 94, 95, that each of those SummerSlams was headlined by what in retrospect, and largely at the time a lot of people in the know said, was a colossally bad idea.
Yeah.
Now, sometimes they tried, and it was a little more successful. I think starting at SummerSlam 93, would you like me to jump into this? I didn't know if you had a counter. Okay.
93.
When you go to 93, obviously the big angle was Lex Luger made in the USA. They literally tried to fill the void left by Hogan with a new Hogan.
2.0.
Yeah. Now, anyone who had been following Lex Luger's career up to that point knew that, you know, he was a guy who was really good at getting to that top level, but once he got to that top level, people were like, he's okay, he's not great. We saw, 1988, Dusty Rhodes was adamant about making this guy a NWA champion.
Yeah.
Ric Flair's like, no, I don't think he is. Let's wait for Sting. I'll drop the title to Sting.
Well, and that reared its head again in 90 when Sting was hurt, and they wanted to put it out. It wasn't Dusty.
The grand irony is that they waited too long for Sting. I mean, not all their fault. Yeah. I mean, they were going to do it a few months earlier originally before he tore his knee.
Well,
but
Luger also had the sense because of that in a kayfabe sense. For us aftermag readers at the time, Luger had the kayfabe sense of can't win the big one because he didn't beat Ric Flair in those high-profile matches and only got the WCW world title when Flair was out of the picture. Very tainted.
Exactly, and he wasn't very good at it either.
No.
His contract, he had a very cushy contract. I mean, I don't even think he wrestled for 2 months before he dropped the title and left the promotion.
They had him doing a dime store Flair imitation instead of letting him be like an extension of himself. Like in 89, he had a great heel run, but 91 was nothing like that.
Agreed. And it actually was so good of a heel run that he wound up turning face. It wound up being out of necessity, but he was getting a lot of cheers during that 89 heel run.
Right.
Anyway, we digress. Mm-hmm. So he came in as the Narcissist, which it was a dumb name.
Yep.
And a lot of people make fun of that. I didn't think it was that terrible. It was a little like WWE-ish over the top. But I remember it always seemed that they were... It's funny how plans can change, and it's all Hogan's fault, of course. But, you know, at the kind of right around WrestleMania 9 time, it seemed you had a Bret Hart. Well, it didn't seem. He was the champion.
Yeah.
You know, it hadn't really been established. Certainly shadow of Hogan. I don't think as many people were buying him as he or the company would have wanted to.
Right.
But it's, remember they kind of teased a Hart-Luger feud? Luger knocked him out after, like, at the WrestleMania 9 luncheon.
That's where they were going, and I think you said that the plan was going to be that at King of the Ring, Hart was going to beat him.
Yes, and it never wound up happening, and Hogan obviously balked at doing the return job, you know, doing the big passing of the torch match to Bret Hart.
Right.
And so they got left in it, so Vince panicked, puts the title back on Yokozuna, because he felt, for whatever reason, that Bret just beating Yokozuna back would have kind of made Bret look bad.
By the way, they could have gone with that. Yokozuna's the guy who beat Bret Hart, not Hulk Hogan. They could have gone for the rematch at SummerSlam.
They could have. I didn't follow that logic from Vince. Now, hindsight's 20/20. I do kind of want... I mean, it doesn't excuse the fact that we had to sit through a terrible second half of 93, but I kind of like the way they did it anyway. I mean, you know, I've professed my love with you before on WrestleMania 10 and the way it was done. And, and just... Because it was just so great how Bret totally... just showed up Lex Luger, let's be honest. But, again, we're getting ahead of ourselves.
Yeah.
So the big angle they do here is July 4th, USS Intrepid. I've been on the boat before since then.
Okay.
You know, they turn Luger babyface. They, you know, Yokozuna had the big challenge or whatever. You know, they went with the old hackneyed foreign menace. Oh, on the 4th of July, I'm going to be on this, you know, naval boat, and let's see which one of your heroes can slam me. He was a big surprise thing. I thought, believe it or not, and this contradicts what I just said, everything I've just said. Mm-hmm. It was well done. Now, they were kind of putting a shiny coat on poop.
Yeah.
But the Lex Luger Yokozuna, the whole build to that particular match that headlined SummerSlam 93 in Detroit could not have been done better. Now, that doesn't mean it was great, but I don't think, I'm going to submit this to you and I'm going to stop babbling incoherently. I don't think they could have done it better.
Or the Lex Express and everyone.
If
you're determined to shoehorn Luger into that role, I mean, I guess you're right. They executed it about as well as they could have.
Yeah, I mean, I'm saying you can tell me till I'm blue in the face, sorry to cut you off, that a patriotic Lex Luger challenging, you know, a world champion Yokozuna is a terrible idea to be your headline program if you're at any point in time.
Sure.
I'll agree with that. Mm-hmm. But if you're going to go with it, I don't think they could have done it any. I mean, I know everyone, the Lex Express, which you referenced, is much maligned. You know, if you weren't around that time, they literally put him in a bus and just had him drive across. But, I mean, I don't know. I mean, what would you have him do?
Well, no.
Wrestle? I mean, would you? Well, I mean, I guess they could.
I agree.
Well, in 97, I will say, again, looking way into the distant future, when they got him over for that short period of time, probably the most he'd ever been over in his career, 97 WCW, they did have stupid torture rack over, like, no move in the industry. I mean, remember, like, how over that move was?
It was.
But who knows if they could have done that? And, I mean, you know, you're not going to get him over by doing 20-minute classes.
No. Listen, that was the better way of doing it. I mean, I just brought that up for a giggle. But, yeah, no, I thought that was, you know, again, if you're going to do this, that's the way to do it. You got to give it the hard sell. The problem was also, too, it's one of these things. Typical WWF, especially of that time, Vince McMahon wants you to look at the guy in a vacuum of just his WWF tenure. And this included the WBF also. That's how he came in, was as a bodybuilder in 92. Yes. The thing is, again, to the larger audience, and wrestling had already at that time become the binary system of the territories, except for Memphis, and we'll talk about that in a little bit here. They're all gone. It's just WCW and the WWF. Everybody knew who Lex Luger was.
Yeah, I mean, even
and his reputation and the things in a kayfabe sense that were damaging came in with him. And that's what the fact that the patriotic persona didn't fit with the Lex Luger who'd been in the national spotlight since 1987, not 1992, Vince, that is where it came off a little bit weird.
Well, that was ultimately his downfall.
Yeah.
Is that he...
It seemed forced.
Yeah, it just... Lex Luger is the slapping hands made in the USA babyface. He tried.
Yeah.
But it just always kind of came across as, and I don't know Lex Luger, obviously, yeah. but he always just kind of seems like a prick. You know, he didn't seem like that was his nap. He wasn't, look, here's the, let's bring it full circle. Mm-hmm. Like, he wasn't Hulk Hogan.
Well, and you know
I mean, who also is a prick, but could be, you know, could come across as far more likable
right.
to the fan base.
Well, you and I have been criticizing them, the company, going back to the SNS days of 06, roughly. And I think it was, I don't know if they're doing it as much now, but they were really guilty in the mid-2000s, at the very least, of prefabbing things. You're going to be this guy. You're going to be this guy. We're going to take you and shoehorn you into this role. Lex Luger is the first big example of that I can remember, of them trying to do that. Maybe to a certain extent, some of the cartoon characters of the 80s, but none of them seem nearly as forced as Lex Luger seemed.
It definitely seemed, well, clearly in retrospect, I mean, you know, when you have, you know, what is it now? 19 years.
Yeah.
19 years to go back and look at this.
Yeah.
It's just so obvious that it was what you said at the outset, Hulk Hogan version 2.0.
Yeah.
And even at the time, you know, I'm 12, 13 years old mm-hmm. at this time. You know, I'm kind of thinking, okay, well, they're just, it was even obvious then.
Right.
And it didn't work ultimately, and I'm going to get to that why in a second.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought building in, they, again, I just kind of want to make that clear. I'd like to hammer these points home, I know, endlessly, it seems, and repeat myself. But I just think they couldn't have done a better job building what on paper was just not a good idea. I mean, as
right.
we go, as we kind of look at some of the other bad ideas they had during this time period, they were bad ideas compounded by bad execution.
I agree.
They couldn't have built a Lex Luger babyface versus Yokozuna. I mean, Yokozuna obviously is the idea of him as any sort of
it was
decent babyface is ridiculous. But,
right.
you know, a babyface Luger challenging Yokozuna, I don't think they could have built it any better.
Yeah.
And I think at the time, I know this is, you know, people might snicker now, I think people would have wanted, and certainly those who were there and those who bought the show on pay-per-view did want to see him win the title.
Right.
And the big joke is they didn't do it, and that ultimately, I think, to what you said, you know, in that kayfabe sense, Luger's
yeah.
a guy, yeah, okay, he never wins the big one. He only got the world title because Flair bolted on the NWA. That cemented this thing as, okay, it's like, look, you got us to buy in. I'm speaking as mm-hmm. Joe wrestling fan now. You got us to buy into this seemingly bad idea.
Yeah.
Against all odds, we bought into it. And then he kind of screwed us over by doing, and of course, if you haven't seen this show and you don't know, they did this finish where he wins by countout. And
yeah.
they celebrated like it was this unbelievable victory. And I remember just being like, at the time,
mm-hmm.
being like, what?
When he was contractually prohibited from getting another rematch.
Well,
they were going to do it with a Royal Rumble, but they got greedy. They fell in love with the chase. Let's prolong the chase another 8 months.
And see, that I think proves my theory.
Yeah.
That this was, believe it or not, against all odds, working to a degree. Now, I'm not saying that
I agree.
Business would have changed significantly better with Lex Luger as a babyface champion in the second half of 1993, but I think... Well, I know. Clearly, they thought it was working well enough. They're like, oh, okay, we're going to put a lot of heat on this. He's going to come in with all this momentum. He's going to win by count out. Because, yeah, this is when Jim Cornette debuted, by the way,
yeah.
the great Jim Cornette. And he came on, and they did the, you know, building up to the show. They did the angle where this is your only shot. You get one shot at him.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't win the title, you're hosed. Well, they figured that they'd be able to keep this momentum going for so long. Okay, we'll put Lex in the Rumble. It'll be his, you know, again, his only shot. He'll win it, and we'll all go home happy as he wins the title at WrestleMania, the big mm-hmm. show, and that'll kick off this new Lex Luger era. Well, as we saw, Rick Morris, the momentum is soon, whatever momentum they were able to manufacture going into mm-hmm. the event was completely lost after this. I mean, this thing, what they started having a feud with, like, Ludwig Borga.
Yeah.
And the Lex Luger babyface push just died. I mean, it was just bad. And the other theory or concept, it's not a theory really, that I think we're going to be looking at with these first three WrestleManias is there were some real constants that were good. You know, while at the top they had a lot of bad ideas,
mm-hmm.
the workers were starting to give time. I mean, again, why? You know, steroids, allegations.
Right.
That's the only reason, basically, Bret and Hart and Shawn Michaels got their shots.
Right.
And on these shows, these, you know, kind of down period Summer Slams, they did get their time to shine. And Bret ultimately just proved, as, you know, anyone with half a brain knows now, that he's just 10 times the performer Lex Luger ever could dream of being.
Right.
And, you know, on this show, I think he proved it. I mean, my right. favorite part of SummerSlam 93 is the whole Bret Hart, Jerry Lawler segment.
Yeah, and we'll talk about that. The thing about Luger, and I agree with you, just to wrap that point, I think the analogy I would use is it was a beautifully engineered, ugly house. I mean, that basically...
Yes, that's a, like I
impeccably
said...
Impeccably engineered.
They put a wonderful coat on poop.
Yes.
I mean, I know that's, you know...
No, that's true.
That's a far less scientific way of putting it, but they
true.
Did. I mean, when you go back and... I mean, the crowd was kind of... If you watch that show, for me, you know me,
right.
I always like, when to get into something, I just watch it.
Right.
And when you watch that show, the crowd was fired up and wanted a title change. And you can't, especially now,
right.
you can't always say that the crowd is really... honed in on, you know, I mean, granted, the industry's changed so much in the last near 20 years, but you can't say the crowd is just always desperate for that baby face to come in. Now, part of it is because their hopes and dreams have been killed by the promotion,
right.
but that's a different podcast
that
for
is.
A different day. Thank
that
you
is,
very
exactly.
much.
Yeah, and that's, again, Luger represented, as we discussed off air, I think there were six, this is how much they bounced around during these years, and by the way, I think it's FDH Lounge mini episode number 40, if you want to check out us talking the years 92 to 96 in both promotions. You and I also covered some of this ground on our WrestleMania podcast that people can check out, but that there were six different eras during this period of time, starting shortly after SummerSlam 92, the very abrupt change. So Bret Hart had already been on top and had it cut short by this time. That was the first one. The second era was the Lex Luger era. Lex was the only guy out of the six never to get the belt. We circle back to Bret, who they basically had in the 1A spot at this point here, and their sort of consolation prize for him not being in this spot here. He wins King of the Ring. He's attacked by Jerry Lawler doing the whole I'm the real king
Which
deal.
Makes sense. Again, that's something people could get behind. I know you're going to go
in. I don't
in
see and... Jerry Lawler attacking subsequent Kings of the Ring for being pretenders. But
well, because what was he going to do every year? What's he going to do every year?
Am I being Nelson Nitpicker
yes,
on that?
Yes, you okay. are. That's come, right. Stop that.
Okay.
And okay, if you want me to come back, here, Bill Apter just called. The next two guys were heels.
Yeah,
okay.
That's true.
All right. Next three. Next four.
I don't think Bill Apter used
As a matter of fact, there was
heel.
Not another babyface King of the Ring winner until Ken Shamrock.
That's right.
Okay, what do you got to say about that?
By the way, what I got to say about that is that I believe Bill Apter calls them rule breakers. This is another thing we discussed off air, too. Them putting Lawler in that spot here, it's a confluence of things that in the post-steroid era that they were in at this point in time, they were defined in a large way in the cartoonish 80s by being a steroid company and by training, for lack of a better way of describing it, the rubes to relate to that. Now in 1983...
Larger than life.
Yeah, you've got Jerry Lawler, this tremendous Memphis veteran, but somebody who's not seen as big league by the rubes. And
But like Luger was known.
True.
I mean, probably not as well known as Luger, but,
yeah.
you know... I'm
First
a,
time on the national stage
yeah,
consistently.
But I clearly...
I mean, ESPN in 88 for being the AWA
yeah.
champion,
I mean, that
but
was,
beyond
yeah.
that...
Yeah,
but, and
if you're
but,
older, obviously yeah. you know him from the Andy Kaufman stuff.
Well,
I mean, there was a
yeah.
time period where you could say he was the talk of the industry.
True, but I'm going to tie this in also the more I think about it. You mentioned Jim Cornette managing Yokozuna. He also had the Heavenly Bodies going up, who were, I guess, the Smoky Mountain Tag Team champions at the time, going up against the Steiners.
I can't remember if they were in exile or if they were the champions.
I don't remember, but I think they were the champions.
I'll have to get my Smoky Mountain video tape set
out. It's one of these things where now they're acknowledging other companies. Strangely enough, they didn't acknowledge the USWA with Lawler being there, but they acknowledged Smoky Mountain Wrestling. It came off not as big time.
Yeah, although you know what they were doing, and the real
great crossover
the tape traders of the day really
yeah.
love this stuff.
Vince McMahon prototype.
Yeah, when Vince McMahon, it was around this time, and
yeah.
they were taping this stuff and not showing it all on TV.
Yeah,
they at all they would at the house shows or the Raw tapings they would do it after they'd have King's Courts where what would eventually become the Mr. McMahon character Vince would do this stuff. And there's a YouTube channel where someone literally has, I can't remember the guy's name. And
there's like 30 parts to it, yeah.
Okay, you've seen it. You know what I'm talking about.
Not the whole thing, but yeah.
All right, folks. I don't want to get anyone in trouble, anyone thrown off YouTube. It's called McMemphis. Just do a YouTube search for McMemphis, I think, and you'll find this. Vince McMahon doing the original incarnation of the Mr. McMahon character in USWA.
Mm-hmm.
Incredible.
Yep.
I mean, incredible. I mean, him just ripping on hillbilly, like just this hillbilly form of wrestling is incredible.
He had it in him all along.
You're right. There was...
It undermined their sense of being big time on their cartoonish terms.
Yeah, you're right. Heavenly Bodies were on this card. And just as an aside,
right.
They have a pretty fun match with the Steiners. I like the 93 show overall. You're right. It wasn't as big time, but I like the 93 show.
And I don't want anybody to misconstrue this. I've said before, I was always, my preference was the NWA. All right? I grew up on that stuff. I grew up on preferring the non-WWF style. So I'm not bashing by saying this, but what I'm saying is that the majority of people out there weren't like me. The majority of people, frankly, the mouth breathers, you know, just loved this stuff, loved the cartoonish stuff. Oh, I can't get enough of these big guys clubbering one another. And then you got Jerry Lawler coming in, and what I said to you off air was Harley Race at a similar point in his career. The Funk Brothers at a similar point in their career weren't as near the top of the card as Lawler was. This was, for all intents and purposes, the semi-main event at SummerSlam here with him doing the program with Bret Hart.
And he was an announcer, too.
He was an announcer.
Which is something that Terry Funk and Harley Race were.
Yeah. So, I mean, it was a fun type of deal you know, Bret first wrestled Doink. They tied in the Doink storyline of where Lawler
And they had a fun little match. Yeah. Lawler came out and did a total Memphis shtick.
Yeah.
Where he came out on crutches, that he had saved orphans in like some burning bus. It's really hilarious.
Right.
By the way, this is, I think, Bobby Heenan's last pay-per-view. No, he did Survivor Series, too.
Yeah.
But he was it's amazing how badly his career just died when he got to WCW, because he was so funny, I remember, during the show. But
well, he was probably sober during this show also.
Yeah. But, Lawler says he can't wrestle, and he... brings Doink out, and Bret beats Doink up, and Lawler gets involved. It's obviously, you know, everyone knows it's a ruse. He's not really hurt. And then Bret just totally beats the holy hell out of Lawler, and they reverse it. He beats him, like, he just won't stop kicking his, just beating his brains out. That they reverse the decision, and Jerry Lawler announces the official king, which maybe is why he didn't attack subsequent Kings of the Ring. Thank you very much.
Oh, might be.
But the Hart family was there. This is kind of when they started bringing Owen back, too, after that failed singles push of 92.
He wrestled a dark match. He beat Barry Horowitz.
Oh, Jesus. I wasn't even referencing that. I was just saying him and Bruce were at ringside. And
right.
It was just it was a very different WWE at this show than we'd ever seen. You know, it's funny, 92 was called the SummerSlam you never thought you'd see. This was really the SummerSlam you thought you'd never see. Cornette, Smoky Mountain, USWA stuff. I mean...
Ted DiBiase's swan song as a wrestler, the last before he hurt his neck.
Yeah, the only thing more perplexing on this was 1-2-3 Kid doing with a lot of momentum doing a clean job to IRS
in 5:44.
Yeah,
Shawn Michaels and Mr. Perfect having an underachieving match for the Intercontinental Championship.
Yeah, that's what's interesting about me liking this show is that match, which was clearly designed to be the highlight in ring wise, stunk.
Right,
it stunk.
Right,
Shawn Michaels and Mr. Perfect could not possibly have had a worse match. Although I've heard rumblings that Perfect was promised the Intercontinental title, and they kind of said, we sort of changed our mind. He may have phoned it in because of that, and he wound up leaving the company shortly thereafter.
Yeah, that may
Why
very...
do I like this show so much, then?
I don't know. I really
love the whole heart, you know, with the brothers beating up Lawler on the stretcher afterwards. That six-man tag's kind of fun, just to reference that.
Swank little six-man tag here, it was...
The Guns and Tatanka versus Bigelow and the Head Shrinkers.
I mean, there's...
That's not.
There's not a lot of workers in there that I like. Bam Bam, but I mean, if the rest of them drove off a cliff in a flaming school bus,
Jesus. Okay,
I wouldn't miss their work.
Look, I hated the smoking.
I'd mourn their families, but I wouldn't miss their work.
I hated the Smoking Guns because I didn't like their jeans and wrestling. And
yeah,
jeans.
I never liked them.
Watch this match, kids. It's a fun match where everyone outperforms what you think of them.
By the way, Samoan SWAT team greater than the Head Shrinkers.
Oh yeah. But that's and. It's interesting that you talk about – watch this seamless transition here if you're ready. If you're ready, work with me.
Yep.
Are you ready?
I'm hanging on.
Okay. You talk about the different eras that, you know, they kind of went with six different guys, Bret twice.
Yep.
So Luger fails miserably in that top spot. They go back to Bret.
Yep.
Brett is then the champion, wins the belt at
That's
WrestleMania
the third,
10.
Third era.
In glorious fashion.
Yep.
They have this one. If you want to hear me extol the virtues of this feud, go listen to the WrestleMania 10 podcast.
Mm-hmm.
They set up this wonderful feud with Owen Hart, because if you're obviously, everyone knows, WrestleMania 10, Brett wrestled twice. He wrestled in the first match, suffered a shocking clean loss to Owen Hart, made Owen an instant main eventer, and then Brett wins the title in the last match against Yokozuna. So, wonderfully, you have your main event title program through the summer completely set. Brother versus brother, Brett versus Owen. Owen wins King of the Ring in the interim. Mm-hmm. A terrible pay-per-view, by the way.
Yeah.
Oh. Yeah. Other than Owen Hart kind of being solidified as a main eventer, that show stunk, okay? And the thing that stunk most was Artie Donovan's commentary, which has been ripped on in multiple news outlets.
Bret Hart with the first of what would be like 900 non-finishes with Diesel.
Yeah, they did that. But yet always good matches.
Yeah, they were.
But so SummerSlam, it's Bret versus Owen. Most people, myself included, feel this is one of the top SummerSlam matches of all time.
Yeah.
It's certainly, I believe, the best WWE cage match under the with the stupid blue bars. It's probably the best WWE cage match ever.
Right. Best one ever in the Mattel cage, I'll give you that.
Yes, and certainly in the Mattel cage. That's very nice, Ricky.
Thank you.
I'll tell you what, your writers are working overtime.
The good ones borrow, the great ones steal.
Okay, there we go. Yes, well, hey, you know, I hope you remember that when after you ripped on that poor ESPN guy when we were off air. But so you had this wonderful cage match at SummerSlam 94 between Brett and Owen. You know, Dave Meltzer, the Melt, you know, himself, has this as one of the one of the 4 5-star matches of the 1990s in the company. I go 4 3/4. I'm kind of a stickler. I like the WrestleMania match actually better.
Okay.
Just because you knew Brett was getting his win back here. And the rules of this of the cage, because it was escape rules too, which you know also hurt the Mattel cage matches, as you put it so well. I just don't think you can do a perfect... I'd feel guilty about giving a Mattel cage match the full Monty.
Well, and
even though they did it, because they really, more than any cage match ever, made use of the... They're like, okay, well, there's no blood, and we've got to focus on the escape. And they did a lot of cool spots. I remember one in particular. It's great where one keeps diving for the door. They pull them. They dive over.
Right.
It's a great spot. And it's a great match. Like I said, it certainly stands to me as one of the 2 or 3 best, and I'm not without having any sort of list written in front of me right now. It's one of the 2 or 3 best SummerSlam matches ever.
Having said that, though.
But, yeah. You know where I'm going?
What?
Let's bring it full circle. What did I say our theme was at the outset of this program? Stupid creative ideas on top.
Right.
This match did not close the show. Did they elect to headline SummerSlam 94 with?
Before we get to that abortion, let me just ask you this. I mean, I have another theory about that match also, and one of the things that hurt. And again, I am a huge mark for Owen Hart, a big fan of his career. Yet, coming only 2 years out of the end of the steroid era in 92, could the public be conditioned at that point to think of a guy his size? 98, 99, 2000 maybe. Was 94 pushing it to have both him and Brett on top?
Great point, and that's maybe why they did. And see, what a great interlude by you, Rick Morris.
Okay.
What a phenomenal
interlude by you, Rick Morris.
That's
what I do.
I can't believe what a point that was, Rick Morris. You're right. Well, here's the thing. Again, I'm going back. My birthday's in August. Not that anyone cares, but I'm 13, 14 at this time in 1994. My birthday is always right around SummerSlam, and I didn't buy Owen as having a chance. Like it was really now it's we would say, oh well, Brett's obviously getting his job back.
Right.
You know, I didn't use that terminology
right.
in 94, but that's clearly what it was. It was such a shock to the system to see him win at WrestleMania 10.
Yeah.
But what made his win so great and monumental at WrestleMania 10 also was kind of his undoing here, because, like, okay, well, if he wins, now he's going to be the champion, and I don't see him being the champion. It was a great feud. It was the absolute right match to do.
Right.
Even if it wasn't going to set any sort of business records, it was the absolute right match to do at SummerSlam. You know, they had tied in the family a lot
more.
Jim Neidhart with Owen, the British Bulldog returns with Brett.
I just think the public had a ceiling on Owen.
They always did.
Yeah.
They always did. That's why, a lot of people, again, moving way far ahead, the Chad Repex, the gratuitous plug, always has to be mentioned every podcast, was always so up in arms that Owen didn't get the title when he came back in 98. He had so much heat on him, you know, after the Brett. Like no one bought that.
If
man.
Not for Austin, though. But I mean, you couldn't do it because of Austin. But look, he was hotter as a babyface than he ever was as a babyface at any other point in his career.
Or even maybe as well.
And maybe about as hot as he was as a heel here.
Yeah.
But it's a
those are the two peaks of Owen Hart's career. Those are the two peaks.
Minus Austin, I could have bought him at least for a short period of time on top as the
champion
babyface.
Especially in the monthly pay-per-view era. Which, by the way, I know is a big point you want to hammer on soon. That we're still in SummerSlam 94. You have to remember, we are not in the monthly pay-per-view era where he can win it and then lose it the next month, the next pay-per-view.
It was the other thing, too, of Brett had been wrestling Owen at the house shows over the summer.
It had sort of played out.
Yeah,
as a matter of fact, I think on one of they debuted the Action Zone. Remember that fine program at noon on USA Network? And I think, like, shortly after this, they had, like, this is Owen's last chance. Like, that's always the acknowledgement. Okay, we've burned this field
right
to the ground.
Right. And that was, but again, a great match. But again, and
I've got it, by the way, number two SummerSlam match of all time.
Okay.
Listen
right.
on to find out what my number one SummerSlam
good.
Match
okay.
of all time is.
And again, I'll ascribe that to the public stupidity if they put a ceiling on Owen Hart. He didn't deserve it, but I'm acknowledging reality.
I think it's legitimate, though. I didn't buy Owen. I didn't. Do you think that Owen should have gone over here?
No. But that's, you know,
Then again, they did push Bob Backlund in the months that followed and put the title on him.
Like, immediately. That was kind of a panic move.
Although that was kind of a transition move.
Oh, the very definition. But, yeah, you were talking about the main event here, Undertaker v. Under Faker. They'd done the angle here with Yokozuna when he put him out at the Royal Rumble. Undertaker was out of action for a long period of time here. In one of the most embarrassing angles ever, they acted like he died and was resurrected during that show.
You're going to be shocked by this. I don't hate that as much as everyone else does.
Oh, I do. I
gather
biggest
that.
Biggest wrestle crap moment I can remember.
A lot of people talk about how the Undertaker business wise was really hurt by this whole thing. I'm not going to disagree with those people because they're maybe smarter than I am. But I remember he was so invincible that. I guess you had to go. I mean, it was terrible. What am I talking about?
It was.
This didn't help.
Yeah, and that was the only WrestleMania he missed during the streak. He didn't come back until the summer. They did the whole thing of, Ted DiBiase, who was the original guy who brought him in 1990. Rare continuity from the WWF, by the way, to acknowledge the pre-Paul Bearer Undertaker.
And here's the thing, too, that they were going with underneath. Mm-hmm. Like, this just shows the weakness, too, of that era.
Yeah.
Remember the Ted DiBiase Corporation? That was just getting started here.
I read this just the other day. They never held a single belt the whole time they were together.
It was a bad heel group. You know, the Click influence, by the way, is the other thing. Those are two things that we need to talk about.
Yeah.
We'll talk about the Click influence in a moment.
Yeah.
Because I think that's key to transition to 95. But this Undertaker versus Under Faker, and they didn't call him the Under Faker. That's kind of like an internet term, the Under Faker.
Or After Mags at the time.
But here's the thing about this, again. And I'm going to actually not be as critical as you think I would be.
Okay.
It was sort of compelling. It was, like a babyface Lex Luger challenging for the world title. It's a stupid idea on paper. But it did build some heat for the Undertaker's return. But the problem was once that everyone, even the littlest kid in Road Double Z, figured out, okay, Teddy Biasi has this fake Undertaker.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone's like, okay, can the real Undertaker just come back? And they had this little problem of, we have to have a match.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to say this right now. It's going to come across as hyperbole, but I defy anyone to find me an example to the contrary. I don't think you'll ever find a more heatless main event than this in the history of the company. No one. I mean, you could hear Vince McMahon acknowledged it on commentary. He's like, this crowd is sort of just stunned here. They don't know what to make of this.
Well, not only that.
And Vince clearly, about halfway through, I think, kind of got what I just said there.
Mm-hmm.
Because that has never been. This was like one of those things that was immediately erased. Like, no one ever talked. Oh, remember when the Undertaker feuded with the fake Undertaker? I mean, within weeks, this was not referenced.
Vince McMahon will go into a 5-minute monologue on camera about the life and times of Chris Benoit before he ever references this match ever again.
Yeah.
But having said that, I always wondered this too. Even if it's just you figure the folks in the cheap seats at the United Center, how are you supposed to tell them apart? I mean, maybe on TV there was a way. I don't remember. But if you're further back in the crowd, how can you tell if the Undertaker you like is on offense?
This is one of those
things.
There's
never been a match like that before where it was as confusing.
That's a valid point. I'm going to say
this. They were dressed identical. Yeah. I mean, one was a little bigger, but Kyle, they were dressed just about identical.
Yeah, and of course, you know, no one can work as bad as Brian Lee, but that's a different story. Again, different podcast, different day.
And this was 1994 Mark Calloway, who wasn't capable of carrying him.
Yeah, which was a problem. This is one of those things that I think is a complaint that's much more applicable today.
Yeah.
Where you have, you know, and again, it's not always Hollywood, right? You know, that's kind of a lazy excuse to blame the Hollywood writers. They're not the ones who ultimately make the final call. But when you take the idea that wrestling is TV and not wrestling,
right?
That, okay, this kind of works if it was a TV show, but you have to remember wrestling. You have to, at the end of the day, you got to deliver this little thing called a pro wrestling match,
right?
And I think they kind of this is going to sound insane. Mm-hmm. I think they kind of forgot about that. I think they just assumed. This is one of those things that instead of main eventing,
right,
it should have been in the middle of the show.
Get it out of the way. Yeah.
And it should have been like 10 seconds.
Yeah.
Where he just comes out. By God, the Undertaker is. That's the real Undertaker. That's Paul Bearer's. Tombstone over.
Yeah.
Like as soon as he came back, the crowd's like, yes, he's back. And it's like, oh, crap, we've got to sit through this match. And no one responded. I will go on record. Not only was this the most heatless main event ever, but coming off the heels of Bret Owen in the cage. Mm-hmm. I'm going to say, and again, I welcome anyone to find me an example of the contrary, the largest drop-off in match quality from one match to the next in the history of pay-per-view. You're going from Bret Owen, which almost gets the full Monty, I said 4 3/4,
yep,
to this, which is like -4.
Well, not only that.
I mean, you're talking about one of the best matches of the 90s to one of the worst. Easily a top 10 best match of the 90s to a top 10 worst match of the 90s. That's almost unprecedented.
Here's the thing. With only one long match the entire night, 32-17 for the title match, this one being 8:57, there's like no doubt in my mind whatsoever. The thing came into the referee's earpiece, bring it home, boys, way before. There's no doubt they cut this off early at 8:57. Yeah. That pay-per-view was probably off the air at 10:20.
I'd love to go back and find that out.
Well, here's the match time. 6:45, 8:10, 13:55, 6 minutes, 5:45, 32:17, and 8:57. Even allowing for Leslie Nielsen's approximately 900 skits during the course
of
the show.
None of which were funny. And Leslie Nielsen's kind of a funny guy, but it didn't work.
They gave him crap stuff to work with. Let's just gloss super quick over the rest of the card here. Rap v. Country. Jeff Jarrett defeated Mabel in a singles match.
Yeah, that's an idea so bad only Vince McMahon could come up with
Tatanka
it.
Tatanka defeated Lex Luger.
Oh, by the way,
Tatanka sold out to the corporation.
Hold on.
Yeah.
Keep that in mind. Jeff Jarrett beat Mabel. Keep that in mind, kids.
At 5:45, bookmark that. Tatanka was the one that joined the corporation, not Lex Luger. Yawn.
You know what? Again, Raw, I've changed, Rick Morris. I'm a changed man. Watch this saying. I'm not saying that to heel Tatanka.
The better if you're putting over Russell crap to me.
My people, you know, my people should have done this long ago. Look, this was not going to set the world on fire.
Mm-hmm.
I thought this was the way to go. It was, I think it drew some, I think some people were shocked that Lifetime Babyface Tatanka turned here. Again, by the way, this put just one more nail in the career of Lex Luger. When you're getting beaten by a heel turned Tatanka, boy, is your place known.
That's true. Diesel and Shawn Michaels had won the tag team titles the night before.
The Click.
From the Head Shrinkers. The belts would not be defended. It was Razor defeating Diesel for the Intercontinental Championship the next night. Meanwhile, the Head Shrinkers lost by DQ to IRS and Bam Bam Bigelow, the corporation.
Yeah, that was the managers got involved. Yeah. Albano off. But
this was the Razor Diesel blow off Click love fest here. Walter Payton in the corner of Razor Ramon
and Shawn Michaels completely carried all three of them.
Yeah,
he from the corner. He was just running. Walter Payton was kind of a big star to have you that terrible Razor Ramon shirt on. It didn't seem like he cared much. Jared Payton, by the way, former Miami Hurricanes running back, I believe, celebrated at the end of this thing.
Yes.
Razor Ramon was a big star.
It's
sad to see what he became
when
you watch this match. This, next to Bret Owen, was clearly the second best part of the show.
Consistently the one B or 1C babyface. For most of the SummerSlams we're talking about, he was way near the top of the card. Never in the number one spot, but never lower than three. Always two or three. The other match here, Alondra Blaze defeated Bull Nakano for the WWE Women's Championship, or all WWF their, Women's
yeah,
Championship.
Yeah, all their good matches were in Japan.
Yeah, they were. They were. So, all right, SummerSlam 95, another whole not much to see here kind of a thing, except that we were on to the next era. Diesel was now on top. We referenced it, that Bob Backlund, after the Survivor Series, doing the quick job at MSG to Diesel. Diesel comes into SummerSlam. I mean, this was a long program that he had on top. And interestingly enough, while Hulk Hogan was on top in WCW, and it was a lot of people made the whole thing of, okay, Vince is going back to big guys. He's going in that direction. And that was part of it. But the other thing was, I always did think that, and well, he was a crappy worker or whatever, that he always did have the cool factor. Again, he was a little bit too much smiling Diesel, but still.
Yeah, like smile. We've ripped on that. Like, yeah, smiling Brock. Like, it's like he lost his edge once he became a babyface.
He got neutered somewhat, but the thing of it was,
this is such a bad year. When you that Hogan reign in WCW,
right,
while the Diesel reign was simultaneously going on in WWF, it's just awful. This is like when people say, thank God for ECW and Smoky Mountain to keep me going.
And I've been consistent in saying, I always said, if you're going to go bigger, go just a little bigger to Razor. I would have given Razor the shot well before Diesel. But here's the thing, though, and this is something that occurred to me. What Diesel did have, and he had crappy opponents the whole year. There were no top heels that could work worth a crap. Sid was over but couldn't work. None of the rest of them were over or could work. But what Diesel had going for him, I always did think Vince was right on the money that while he shouldn't have been on top, he did have, there was a little bit of, and I'm not comparing how over he was to Hogan being over in the 80s, a little bit of Hogan for the 90s in that Diesel always had that kind of cool reserve about him. It's not putting the you're not cupping your ear for the crowd, you're just thrusting a fist up in the air and people, a laid back, cool kind of 90s shtick, a little bit ironic in some tiny ways. I did think he was somewhat of a character for the times, but again, they watered him down. He couldn't work worth a crap. This thing here, we talked about Mabel. He's wrestling King Mabel, who won King of the Ring,
Is like one of the top five most awful ideas this company ever had.
Yeah.
I remember, do you know what's funny is, it's funny to read the stuff of that period now in retrospect, because I could kind of tell kayfabe, you know, 14-15-year-old Kyle Ross, that Mabel was getting a bit, this is going back to the spring of 95,
okay,
that, you know, the Men on a Mission did a heel turn,
mm-hmm,
and they sort of just made Moe the second to Mabel.
Right.
I was like, he's getting a big push, but no one really saw him winning the 95 King of the Ring. People assumed it was going to be Shawn Michaels, who by this time had turned babyface after WrestleMania.
Yeah.
And, you know, Undertaker was in that King of the Ring, I think.
Yeah.
And I think he went to a DQ. And people were just like, what? And all the groans, well, it was in Philadelphia, too, which didn't help. And, I mean, the crowd just absolutely manured all over Mabel winning. And it was made worse. So it's like, oh, God, he's going to challenge for the belt at SummerSlam. And I remember this is the period where I was, like, least interested in WWE.
Yeah.
When you look at this undercard, I mean, there's not much you could say about Diesel versus King Mabel. It just sucks. It was that this year's terrible creative idea, King Mabel as your big heel challenger. What are you thinking? As a matter of fact, this card had such little depth, Ricky.
Yeah.
And was so unappealing that at the last minute, they changed what was to be a Shawn Michaels-Sid Intercontinental title match.
Grudge match with
a grudge match, which had a big storyline, because Shawn's babyface turn was precipitated when his then-bodyguard Sid turned on him.
Yeah.
It was the big post-WrestleMania angle. Vince, it's been long to Japan, is like, oh my God, this card is terrible. You know, Bret Hart was stuck wrestling Isaac Yankum. This was not his, you know, exactly banner moment in his WWE career. That's Kane now. Jerry Lawler's dentist at the time, for God's sake. Vince said, oh, my God, we need a good match on this. Let's just do a WrestleMania 10 ladder match rematch, Shawn versus Razor. The click, they had their, maybe Shawn pulled the card. Whoever did it, I don't care that they erased what was a good storyline match.
Right.
Thank God they did it, because that's one of the best matches. That's a top five SummerSlam match.
It is.
I think this match is just, I've seen some people say this is better than the original. I think that's a little silly.
The historical footnote is Sean V. Sid gets exiled to Raw, where it becomes the infamous he beats the three guy, the big guy with three super kicks
by Eric Bischoff. Yes, and that's funny. Yeah. It's funny when we get to the next part.
Yeah.
There's a little thing called Monday Nitro. It's going to be on Monday Night. This is right before Monday Nitro. I think that's important to talk about with SummerSlam 95. It's a, you know, it's a total one-match show in terms of quality with Sean Reyes. Sean gets his win back again.
Right.
Fairly predictable. It's like, okay, you know, the guy who lost the first time is getting his win back.
Right.
The end was a little botched, too, which is kind of why I like the original better.
Yeah.
I'm a stickler for those kind of details, Ricky.
Sean was a little bit more over.
And Sean was clearly... Yeah, Sean was the most over guy in the company
at
this point. And it was clear that the belt was going to go to him
right.
by the next year. But it's funny that, you know, you reference he beat the big guy with three super kicks.
Yeah.
Shortly after the show, what happens? Monday Nitro.
Yep.
Lex Luger, who
yep.
we started about talking at the beginning of this podcast, leaves the company, shows up on the first Nitro.
Yep.
And it's a whole different ball game. And when we get to the next SummerSlam, Ricky,
yep.
for the first time ever, WCW is the better company nationally. And I would make a case, and I will make a case when we reconfer,
mm-hmm.
that it, you know, people could point at the ratings of 97, do what you want. I'm telling you, from a quality-wise, the gap of quality between WCW and WWF was never greater than the second half of 1996.
No, that's true. That's absolutely true. We'll be touching on that in 2B. Just other notes here from SummerSlam 95. Again, we touched on it briefly. The second go round of the Bret Hart Jerry Lawler feud, but this was Isaac Yankem, you know, as the standby here. Don't know why Bret won by DQ at 16:07, but that's how they did it.
Oh, God, he didn't even get a clean win?
No. Bret Hart, who at the time apparently was a raging anti-dentite. You've got The Undertaker.
Well, if you remember, there was a Kiss My Foot match. I mean, it was an awful storyline.
It really was. Undertaker in the blow-off of his feud with Kama. It was a casket match.
Oh,
he won that one at 16:26.
Oh, God.
The names at the time, too. Kama. Why was Mabel still Mabel? If he's doing a heel turn, why is he still wearing purple and calling himself Mabel? Not that it would have made him a good worker, Kyle Ross.
He looked like a clown, but he looked like a clown with that baggy suit.
Call him Viscera, call him Big Daddy V, call him whatever names you thought of.
I hated Big Daddy V.
Okay, you understand. Call him anything else other than King Mabel. It was just really stupid. King whatever
else. Call
me
maybe.
Yeah. Nice. Nice. This looks like your token.
No one will understand that in 3 years, by the way.
No.
or maybe in 5 hours. I don't know.
I think right about at the time of this card, you were probably making spider webs references, were you not?
Oh,
probably.
Oh, there we go.
Very nice. The only other thing here, looks like a little bit of token work rate, throwing a little bit of bone on the undercard here. Hakushi and the 1-2-3 Kid, 927. That must have been pretty swank.
I liked Hakushi during this part. He got screwed.
Yeah. Yeah, but
he was getting baby face pops. I believe he does the old space flying tiger drop during this match.
Not much else to see here other than the historical footnote. Triple H's first, I think this would be pay per view match with the WWF.
Yeah,
he defeated Bob Holly at 7:10.
Didn't Fatu, he's doing it for the kids, wrestle on this show?
Well, the other ones here, the Guns beat the Blue Brothers.
Oh, God.
Barry Horowitz defeated Skip.
A perfectly acceptable wrestling feud.
Okay. Bertha Faye defeated Alundra Blaze for
not
the
perfectly
Women's
acceptable.
Championship. No, there was no other one.
He's
here.
Doing it for the kids. Fatu wasn't on this?
No. Making a Difference Fatu was not on this show.
I thought he was.
No.
He wasn't?
There is no sign of, there was not apparently a dark match either. There was no Making a Difference Fatu. There was no post-heel turn Davey Boy Smith. They could have wrestled one another. That could have been a way to get Davey Boy over
Did
more
he,
as a heel.
Had he turned heel at this point?
Yes. Yes, he had.
It was right before, right?
Before.
Okay.
Yeah, right before then. And it, for all the whole thing of they didn't know Lex was going to jump, and I believe that, but it's just notable that Davey Boy didn't turn on Lex. He turned on Diesel in a match.
Yeah, I think Lex came out to save Diesel at the end of the show.
Might have been,
as a matter of fact.
But again, this is the nadir, and for as much, just previewing the next one here, for as much as you're going to rag on 96, after the pile of garbage we just talked about from 93 to 95, I don't know. To me, I think this might be the trough, and it starts to get a little better.
If you take away the ladder match, which was a desperate last-second put-on,
yeah,
it's tough to not make to it's tough to make the case that this wasn't the low point of WWF.
That
is an awful card.
It's one of the worst pay-per-views. You know what, too? Talk about guys who weren't on this card. For a company that didn't have hardly any depth, Savio Vega wasn't on this one either.
Well, he wasn't missed.
He was always like consistently like what, the number five baby face or whatever.
He got that big push as like the the late addition in the King of the Ring,
with
and
him,
no one cared then either.
With him and Razor both being Hispanics, they were both good friends.
Hey, what's the sound? Hey, what's the sound of 300 pounds of crap hitting the fan? Quang!
Quang! Oh, very nice, very nice. So yeah, so this. Again, we hit what is arguably the low point in company history here with the SummerSlams 93 through 95. Again, to paraphrase some folks out there wearing pink, though, Kyle, it gets better.
As we bring the show to a close, we would like to extend our deepest gratitude to NBC, CBS, ABC, Fox, All Clear Channel affiliates, TNT, TBS, USA, UPN, Deadspin.com, YouTube.com, YTMND.com, MySpace.com, various blogs, Fox News, CNN, CNBC, MSNBC, IamBored.com, Billboard.com, Google.com, ESPN, ESPN2, ESPN News, ESPN Classic, NBA TV, NFL Network, Sports Time Ohio, Athlon Magazine, Comedy Central, Cartoon Network, The Boomerang Channel, QVC, BET, The Spice Channel, Steno Notebooks, Manwich, Papermate Office Supplies, Waitresses, Strippers, Bartenders, Garbage Men, Janitors, Microwave Popcorn, The Writers of The Office, Scrubs, Entourage, My Name is Earl, Oz, Metalocalypse and the Boondocks, Awkwafina, and The Periodic Table of Elements.